is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Lucy May. The largest corruption case in Ohio history is reaching more political leaders. Lieutenant Governor John Husted is scheduled to be deposed in a civil lawsuit filed against First Energy. And earlier this month, lawyers subpoenaed Governor Mike DeWine seeking documents related to the case. We're going to talk about those developments and what they mean today on our weekly news review. Plus, we'll discuss why Hamilton County homeowners can expect a higher stadium tax rebate next year, and we'll hear how FC Cincinnati is preparing for its big Hell is Real showdown this weekend. We're going to start with Ohio State government news. Joining me now are USA Today Network Ohio Bureau reporter Jesse Balmer. Welcome back, Jesse.
Thanks for having me.
And Cleveland.com and Cleveland Plain Dealer reporter Jake Zuckerman. Thanks for being here, Jake.
Thanks for having me on.
Jake, let's start with you. Lieutenant Governor John Husted is scheduled to be deposed by these investors, lawyers for the investors who are suing First Energy in connection with the House Bill 6 scandal. First, give us the Cliff's Notes version of the House Bill 6 scandal and the connection to First Energy.
Yeah, the nuts and bolts of it is that First Energy spent millions and millions of dollars bribing at least two officials. There was House Speaker Larry Householder and Sam Randazzo, who was then the top utility regulator in Ohio. Now, First Energy has admitted to this. Larry Householder has been convicted. Sam Randazzo has not actually even been formally accused. But that's sort of the state of play here. And the basic idea is they gave huge payments to these people in exchange for, in Householder's case, him strong-arming legislation through the state legislature that was hugely lucrative to First Energy. And in Randazzo's case, for one, helping with House Bill 6, Sam Randazzo was seen as really the utility law expert in Ohio, and also for certain favors from his role as chairman of the Public Utilities Commission. Those included getting things out of the way, like a rate review that First Energy had already agreed to, and just a couple of other kind of esoteric, you know, like really niche things that very few people in the state even understand. Mm. And Randazzo was effectively First Energy's man on the inside making it happen.
And Jesse, why will the lieutenant governor be deposed in this case?
Yeah, so like you said, there's a lawsuit that was brought by investors as a result of this scandal. And so they're looking to talk to a number of people involved in this, and they're looking to talk to people who know anything about Sam Randazzo and this $4.3 million payment that he received from First Energy, that First Energy in its deferred prosecution agreement said was a bribe, and Randazzo has said is really just the end of his contract with the company. And so they're looking to know what John Husted knows about that. Also about the passage of House Bill 6, the bill that Jake described. And we know at least from text messages that Husted was pushing for a longer subsidy for the company, which would have meant more money for these two nuclear plants up in northern Ohio.
Jake, I mentioned Governor Mike DeWine also got a subpoena for documents in connection with this case. Explain what that's all about.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to know exactly. And this, you know, it could be what amounts to a fishing expedition. These investors could, you know, they've deposed a lot of witnesses. They could know specifics here, but there were two interesting names that I saw in the subpoena list, which was received. Actually, they wanted documents from John Husted as well. But the two names that stuck out were Dan McCarthy and Alice DeWine. The former, Dan McCarthy, was a lobbyist for First Energy. And as a lobbyist for First Energy, he started a nonprofit called Partners for Progress, which really only existed on paper and in the form of a bank account. And it took $25 million from First Energy, which was the extent of the money it ever possessed. And $15 million of that went to another nonprofit that Larry Householder was convicted of secretly controlling. So this was really just a pass-through entity that was controlled by and operated for the benefit of First Energy. So that's kind of one focus of the subpoena. And the other is Alice DeWine, who is the daughter of the governor who ran for a county prosecutor's race. And First Energy, through a pretty complicated web of intermediaries that Jesse and some of her reporting, I believe, broke the news of. But that money went in the form of independent expenditures to support Alice DeWine. She was running in Greene County, which is really not somewhere that First Energy operates in or cares about. So there's this pretty reasonable question of why is FirstEnergy spending money to benefit a local prosecutor's race in Greene County? And the obvious answer being she is the daughter of the governor. So those seem to be the two focuses of these investors in these subpoenas. As for the deposition, it really is anyone's guess, but John Husted and Mike DeWine appeared at a lot of key moments, a lot of these moments that the prosecutors in the Householder case focused on. Right there is Governor Mike DeWine and John Husted. It's hard to know how to evaluate that, but the investors here are some of the people who really seem to be honing in on what exactly they knew and were doing and why.
Jesse, were there any other names on the list of people who were subpoenaed that kind of stuck out to you?
There were a number of people who either worked for FirstEnergy, were dismissed from FirstEnergy, or played some sort of a role. Names that we've really heard before, former executives, former chief ethics officer who was dismissed. So those are people that you would expect to be on a list like that. There are also two individuals who worked with the former Ohio House Speaker Larry Householder's political campaign that we actually heard from in the federal criminal prosecution as well. And so those will be interesting. And then the kind of pass-through entity that Jake talked about earlier, Partners for Progress, which was really a dark money flow through for FirstEnergy to Householder and others. They have been seeking records from that group for quite some time, and that group has been kind of pushing back too. So we'll see what we might learn from those individuals.
Jake, this is not a criminal case, right? What's at stake with this case?
Yeah, you're right. Like you said, this is not a criminal case. This is totally civil in nature. But anyone involved in any of these cases is paying attention to all the other cases. So any information that gets out could flow from one to the other. So there's a huge interest in any, for any witness, anyone who might have legal liability here to try to keep anything out of evidence that they can or not allow themselves to be deposed. I did ask John Husted and his people, if he plans to make any kind of motion to quash the subpoena, and they declined to comment on legal strategy. So I think that that will be an interesting thread to follow, is will he just sit for this deposition without a fight, or will he mount some kind of legal fight to get out of it? And yeah, when there's this other interesting component in that the U.S. Department of Justice via the U.S. Attorney's Office in the district, they have moved to stop the PUCO, so that's Ohio's regulatory body over utilities. They've moved to stop the PUCO's investigation here. But meanwhile, this civil case, these investors are deposing witnesses and getting more facts, at least into a record privately right now. So I think there's this other interesting question of why has the U.S. attorney moved to limit the regulatory investigations, but not in any way sought to limit the civil case?
And Jake, you mentioned the lieutenant governor's office, their response or, refraining from a response. What has the governor's office said about all this and the subpoena?
Yeah, I think their office for the last few years, anytime new information has come out, has basically been saying that none of this is new and this is all already known, and your people are trying to make hay out of this. Political actors are trying to make hay out of nothing here. So they don't have much of a substantive answer. Governor DeWine was asked about it at an event in person the other day and just said, "Look, we'll send any documents that are requested. I'm not." He gave the impression that he's not sweating it.
We just got an email from a listener named Nicholas. Nicholas emails, could the lieutenant governor ever run for governor when DeWine is out of office? Would he have a chance with the FirstEnergy scandal? Is he thinking about it? Have either of you heard, I mean, Jesse, I'll ask you first. Have you heard the lieutenant governor talking about running for governor?
Yeah, so John Husted is very much interested in running for governor in 2026, and that's my expectation that he will, along with Attorney General Dave Yost, perhaps Robert Sprigg, the current treasurer. So there are a number of Republicans that are going to be very interested in the governor's race once Mike DeWine is done with his term. And I guess we'll see. That's going to be, 3 years, a little under 3 years from now. And so we'll see how much more information we might learn about the FirstEnergy situation from either this lawsuit or any subsequent, criminal or individuals who might be arrested. So it's hard to say right now.
Sure. Jake, are there broader implications for either the governor or lieutenant governor with all of this?
I mean, it's really hard to say. At the least, you'd think that they are fact witnesses who would have some interesting pieces of knowledge here. I mean, they, at the point where FirstEnergy says it first discussed in very explicit terms in some of the texts that have come out, this $4.3 million payment to Sam Randazzo, Governor DeWine had just had dinner with FirstEnergy's CEO and one of their top lobbyists who was very centrally involved in the scheme. John Husted, according to Sam Randazzo's own testimony during his confirmation hearings, was the person who really brought him out of retirement and into the PUCO job. Governor DeWine signed House Bill 6. So at minimum, they intersected in these really important ways with these events that were central to the criminal conspiracy. As far as broader legal exposure, it would be totally speculative. I mean, it really just depends who says what. Although there's this other interesting dynamic in that beyond this civil suit we've been discussing from the investors, Attorney General Dave Yost, who's also, I'd call him within the rumor mill, is interested in running for governor, has an active civil suit against FirstEnergy in relation to these same events. So you have to wonder if the investors are interested in what the governor and what the lieutenant governor might know. Wouldn't Dave Yost be? And Attorney General Yost appeared at the same event, and I asked him that question, and it was kind of an awkward situation because he had previously identified himself as lawyer to Governor Mike DeWine, which he is by virtue of his job. But then I said, "Are you interested in what kind of information the governor and lieutenant governor might know about the course of events here?" And his answer was basically, "Not now, but I could be later, but I also could not be later." So there's just sort of this live landmine on the table in that regard.
Interesting. Jesse, what's next with this case? What are you going to be watching for?
Well, there are a lot of kind of like legal machinations that are going on right now with this case. The FirstEnergy and some of its attorneys have appealed to the US Supreme Court to take a second look at whether this should be a class action lawsuit. And what the Sixth Circuit Court decides on that could be pretty instrumental in what happens next. But also just, does this go to trial? How much of these depositions, how much of these records that are being forked over to attorneys will ever see the light of day?
Well, I want to turn now to another story out of Columbus this week, and that is the Ohio Supreme Court ruled on legal challenges to state House and Senate maps. Jesse, what did the justices do in this ruling?
Yeah, so this was a 4-3 decision, and they essentially said that this is a completely different case than the redistricting cases that were brought to us before, because the key difference being Democrats signed off on these maps. And in the past, they were Republican maps approved by Republicans over the objections of Democrats. And so they technically didn't say these are great maps, but they did say, like, we don't have an active legal challenge before us. So the effect of that is we are going to use these maps in 2024 and beyond. Whether they last through 2030 will really depend on the outcome of a constitutional amendment effort to change how we draw these maps.
Yeah, and I want to talk to that in a minute or two. But first, so do these maps have bipartisan support on the Redistricting Commission?
So the Redistricting Commission approved them 7-0. And I think if you ask Democrats, they would say we were in a horrible negotiating position. We knew that because of changes on the Ohio Supreme Court that we were unlikely to win there like they had in the past. And so they essentially agreed to maps that would protect incumbents, like the people who are already in those positions. And so these maps certainly favor Republicans to the tune of maybe 62% or more of seats in the House and 70% or more in the Senate. But I think they thought, we're in a really bad position and it could get worse. So they signed off on these maps.
And how do these maps align with voting preferences?
So the voting preference preferences are a little closer to 54% Republican, 46% Democratic in statewide elections. That might be a little adjusted if you look at 2022 numbers, where Governor Mike DeWine very handily defeated Democrat Nan Whaley. But these maps are more favoring Republicans than the statewide voting preferences, to be sure.
You mentioned the Supreme Court decision was a 4-3 ruling. I think you said, what did the dissenting justices say about all this?
So this broke down on partisan lines. So there were four Republican justices who said, let's dismiss these cases. And there were three Democratic justices who said, no, we still should be taking a look at this. And these maps aren't fair, even though they got Democratic unanimous bipartisan support. And so they essentially said, we're giving up this authority that the people wanted us to have to make sure maps are fair, and we're kind of punting in this case. So, but they're in the minority right now, and so they don't. Can't really affect the outcome of this case very much.
You referenced this earlier. This is all happening while there's this effort underway to try to replace the Ohio Redistricting Commission. Explain that a little bit and where it stands.
Yeah, so there's a group called Citizens Not Politicians. Everyone has to have a fun name. And they are proposing replacing the Ohio Redistricting Commission and also lawmakers in the case of congressional maps with a 15-member citizen commission that would be selected through a kind of, winding process, but it would involve retired judges and whittling people down, et cetera. And these people would not be able to be politicians or heavy donors to politicians. They couldn't be people who worked on campaigns or the spouses of politicos, for example. And so the goal would be trying to replace people who are making decisions about the districts of them and their friends and their colleagues with people who might be a little further removed from the process.
And are they in the process of collecting signatures to get that on the ballot now? Where are they with that?
Yeah, they just started collecting signatures this week, and their deadline to collect the more than 413,000 signatures that they need would be July of next year. Their goal would be to reach be on the November 2024 ballot. And so we'll see how that goes.
Jake, I want to talk to you now about sports betting. You reported how an Ohio state senator wants to reduce the state tax rate being levied on sports betting operators. Tell us what the rate is now and what this lawmaker wants to do.
Yeah, okay, so that's an easy one. The rate now is 20%, and this lawmaker, Senator Neeraj Antani, wants to cut it in half, just back to 10%, which I would add here was what the this has changed a lot in a pretty short amount of time. But when this program launched in January 1, 2023, it was a 10% gross receipts tax in the state budget that was bumped up to 20% at the behest of the governor, who was upset with some of the advertising and marketing tactics coming from the books. And now Senator Antani wants to bring that back down to 10%.
And so is this senator, is he objecting to how it was done, that it was in the budget bill, that the end result, or both?
Yeah, so he said that he's upset that this was done through the budget and in who I believe he used the words the dead of night when I talked to him. I'd like to point out that the Ohio legislature has been actually on a historical scale uniquely unproductive this year as far as passing bills goes, and most of what they have gotten done is through the budget. So, and they all agree to this, they all take part in this, so it's a bit disingenuous. But he also said that the tax is just too high. Now, if you look at it comparatively, I'd say 20% is on the higher end, but within the median of states. Some states get up to 36, 51%. Some states get down, I think, down towards 6%. So higher end of the medium is probably a fair characterization, but he's saying that the higher you move this, it's not just the sports books that are paying the tax. Effectively, bettors are getting taxed in that they get worse odds on games or less lucrative promotional credits or whatever have yous within the apps.
These taxes that are collected, where do they go? What do they help fund?
Almost exclusively to schools. Some of the money goes to problem gambling. Some of it goes to administration, but the bulk of the money is to K through 12 public and non-public schools.
Do we know what the financial implications of this would be if it passes and the tax goes back down to 10%?
So it's hard to say because there are a lot of different factors that kind of cloud how much money the state has collected. But the basic facts are Ohio has collected $102 million year to date, or actually not year to date. That would be January through October in the program. Ohioans have bet north of $5 billion, and they've won back $4.5 million. All that to say, they have lost hundreds of millions of dollars in these books. But right now, we're looking at a gross receipts that was taxed at two different rates over the course of the year. And at some points, there were popular sports in action, and at other points, there weren't. So it's hard to get a clear picture, but all that to say, it's a lot of money. Ohio has already made $100 million, and that's before the big thick of football season and the start of basketball season, which are both big gambling periods. So it's a hit. It is a hit to the state's books.
Does this idea to bring the tax back down to 10%, does it have support in the state house? Can you tell?
It's hard to say, but the state did get, you know, they did pass this. They passed 10% once, they passed 20% once. Again, that passed through a budget, so it's hard to say how would 10% do on its own. But I'd add that Senator Antani is the only sponsor on this bill. I asked the Senate president about it. They didn't respond. So it's pretty early to tell right now, but there hasn't been some kind of big showing of political support since either the bill was introduced or my story about it was published.
One more thing I want to ask you about, Jake, and that is Ohio is going to get $110 million from a settlement with chemical manufacturers. Tell us what this lawsuit is all about that's being settled and how long ago it was filed.
Yeah, this lawsuit was filed in 2018. It concerns a plant that was owned at the time by DuPont, a chemical company. It was using PFOAs. They're called PFOAs, which is a subset of PFAs, PFAS. I could not even begin to pronounce what that stands for. It's a long chemical-y name.
I'm not going to make you
do that.
For
lack of a better word. And the basic allegation is dating back to the 1960s. DuPont was using these chemicals, and over the decades, and it's really laid out in a lot of detail in this complaint, the company had this growing understanding that these are carcinogenic chemicals. They cause cancers in humans. They have adverse health effects, and they're getting into the groundwater. So they are getting, you know, out and into the air. So they're getting from this plant into the greater environment. And the complaint details multiple of these incidents where the company knew that this was happening. Its officials warned executives, hey, these are dangerous chemicals and they're getting out way beyond our control. And they basically chose profits over the public health and safety. So the complaint was filed in 2018 and it has been really, it's been bogged down in a lot of the court stuff, discovery disputes. And just this week, Governor DeWine and Attorney General Dave Yost announced this $110 million settlement. They said it avoids the risk of a jury trial. It avoids any risk of insolvency from the companies. And this comes, there are a couple kind of important pieces of context here. For one, there have been class action lawsuits against manufacturers of PFAS in the amount of hundreds of millions to even billions of dollars. You know, there's just huge, huge liability here on the table for some of these manufacturers. And this is because there are surveys that estimate nearly half the water in the United States has PFAS in them. But just this week, the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals, which is the federal court that covers, let's see, Ohio, Michigan, Kentucky, and maybe other states, but that court just ruled against a class action lawsuit that wanted to basically name anyone whose blood contains 0.05 parts per trillion of PFAS, which according to the suit would have included every Ohioan and possibly every American. I mean, that's how widespread of a chemical problem we're talking about. And the court dismissed that lawsuit, saying that the plaintiffs just couldn't really trace this very real problem of PFAS contamination to the named defendants. So you'd imagine that a ruling like that depresses the value that anyone suing these same companies could get.
And so is that part of why the state decided to settle?
That was not explicitly said by anyone at the press conference, but the press conference was announced just a day or two after that Sixth Circuit ruling.
Yeah. And what did DuPont say about this settlement? Any comment from the company?
DuPont, they actually they beat Ohio to the new, they had to get a press release out, I believe, before the markets opened. They announced the terms of the settlement. They briefly restated some of the claims against the company, but they really didn't avoid, they didn't really make any substantive comment. They just sort of said, this is what was alleged against us. This is money we will pay to resolve the lawsuit. Have a nice day.
Okay. Well, we appreciate your giving us the update on that. We're going to be talking more about these forever chemicals on Monday during our program. I've been talking with USA Today Network Ohio Bureau reporter Jesse Balmert and Cleveland.com and Cleveland Plain Dealer reporter Jake Zuckerman. Thank you both so much for your time today.
Have a good weekend.
Thanks.
Thanks. Up next, we'll talk about that Hamilton County Stadium tax rebate. This is Cincinnati Edition. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Hamilton County Commissioners voted this week to increase the amount of the stadium tax rebate that homeowners will receive in 2024. But one commissioner says it's still not enough. Joining me now to explain all that is WVXU local government reporter Becca Costello. Welcome back, Becca.
Hello, Lucy.
Hello. Okay, way back in 1996, Hamilton County voters passed this sales tax increase to help fund construction of the Reds ballpark, the Bengals stadium. Part of the deal was that homeowners would get money back in a property tax rebate. The whole stadium sales tax has been very controversial. Fast forward to this week, Hamilton County commissioners voted on how much money to return to homeowners as part of that property tax rebate. Explain how the commissioners voted, what they did.
So it was ultimately a unanimous vote, but not without a lot of debate and discussion ahead of time. So basically, you know, you mentioned that as part of the original deal, this was almost 30 years ago, that homeowners would get a property tax rebate. Now, what officials at the time said was that they would use 30% of the revenue. So it's not 30% of the property taxes, but 30% of the revenue from that sales tax as a property tax rebate. That did happen for quite a long time, but then the economy was struggling, the county budget was struggling, and the primary purpose of that fund is to pay for now maintenance and upgrades to those two stadiums. So it was used to construct them originally. Obviously, they have been fully built for a long time, but it is still needed for repairs and upgrades.
Probably debt relief, too.
And debt relief, yes. Mm-hmm. Thank you. Sorry about that. Debt service, yeah. And so what the kind of key problem is that the county has the obligation to pay for that maintenance and debt service and upgrades, regardless of how much money is in the sales tax fund. So because of that, commissioners in the past and again this year decided not to use a full 30% of the refund or of the revenue for refunds, for rebates. Sorry, we've got rebate, we've got rollback, which is a city thing. We're not saying rollback here.
So many R words.
Sorry about that.
That's okay.
So instead of using 30% of the revenue, the county administration's recommendation was to use about 12.5% this year. And that would be basically split between homeowners in Hamilton County.
You mentioned that this original promise was to use 30% of the taxes collected to offer these property tax rebates. That hasn't happened in quite a while because of the economy and all these other things. How long has it been since that promise has been kept in full?
So consistently, it kind of basically stopped in 2011. And then there were a couple of years, the 30% was used in 2012, there was 29% in 2017, and then the most recent time it was used was in 2022, and that was with the same three commissioners that are on the board now. They did vote to approve the full 30%, but even at the time, two of the commissioners, Stephanie Summer-Dumas and Denise Driehaus, said, we can't do this every year, this is a kind of a one-off thing, we need to make sure there's enough money in that fund for future stuff. So it has happened here and there, just not consistent.
How does this rebate that the commissioners just approved compare to the rebate they approved last year?
So last year, the rebate was using about 10.5% of the revenue, and that equaled about $9.6 million. Now, it is kind of difficult to compare because, again, we're talking about percentage of the revenue from that fund, and that there was more revenue this year than last year. And so that means even if they had kept it at the same percentage as last year, the amount would have gone up a little bit. So it is higher than last year in terms of both percentage and dollar amount. So this year, about 12.4% of the revenue, that equals $12.8 million.
I mentioned that one commissioner argued this wasn't good enough, that they should go the whole 30%. Tell us about that and then kind of the discussion that all three commissioners had about this.
Yeah, and so this is Commission President Alicia Reese, and she, I mentioned the year in 2022 that commissioners approved the full 30%. That was an effort spearheaded by Alicia Reese, and she attempted to do the same last year and this year, but didn't get the support from the other two commission members. And in her mind, you know, her argument is the county made promises to the Bengals in particular to maintain and upgrade that stadium and is legally obligated to fulfill those obligations. She says the county also made promises to taxpayers, to voters, when they passed this sales tax almost 30 years ago, but it's not in the contract, which means they're not legally obligated to fulfill that promise. But she says they are morally obligated, that it's the right thing to do if the fund has enough money in it to this year pay the debt service, pay the repairs and the upgrades, and also do a 30% tax rebate, that the commission should do that. So technically, it is true that the county could approve that. The concern is that if there's an emergency repair that's needed, the county's going to have to pay for that. And if there's not enough in savings and reserve in this fund, they'd have to use the general fund. And that's what pays for everything else the county does, like the sheriff's office, 911 services, job and family services, foster care placement, that kind of thing.
Yeah. And so that was, I believe from your reporting, Commissioner Denise Driehaus was making that argument. Look, we need to make sure we've got plenty of money in this fund because we've got obligations that we have to pay for no matter what. What did Stephanie Summer Odumas say about all this?
Basically the same. I mean, and those concerns are really laid out by the county administration and their recommendation. They really look at the numbers and analyze and say, here's what we think is the wisest, most financially responsible thing to do. And Commissioners Driehaus and Summer Odumas really agreed with that. And it was the kind of thing, like I said, even though Summer Odumas and Driehaus did support Reese and a full 30% rebate back in 2022, at the time, even Summer Odumas and Driehaus were saying, we're not going to do this again. Like this is kind of a one-time thing. So those are concerns that have been known and kind of publicly discussed for a long time.
What will this actually mean for property owners next year with their property taxes?
So this is something that homeowners will see on their 2024 property tax bill. So, it's called a rebate. It's not something like homeowners will get an actual check, but it will be a reduction of their 2024 property tax bill. And it will be $43.70 per $100,000 of home value. So the exact amount will depend on the amount of the value for each home.
Makes sense. Have you heard any public reaction to this since this vote?
No, I've not. There were a couple of folks in public comment. I think the bigger discussion around property taxes has been how much valuations increased this year. I know that's been a discussion on Cincinnati Edition as well. And so that was part of the reason that Alicia Reese was kind of pushing on this hard was folks, property taxes are going to go up this year. And so they are kind of in need, especially middle and lower income homeowners need this help. But the property tax rebate, I think it gets a lot of discussion because the stadium deal is so controversial. And, I think probably every public official now would say it was a bad deal for the county and for taxpayers. But they're kind of stuck with it for now. I don't think, when you look at like $43 per $100,000 of home value, it's not a huge, increase, or it's not a huge benefit, I guess, for the tax bill.
Yeah. Well, and we've talked before on the show, too, about how renegotiations will be coming up soon with the Bengals. When is all that happening? And what, if any, impact does this have on all that?
Well, so the current lease for what is now known as Paycor Stadium will expire in 2026. So there are negotiations have already started on how to pay for things like the repairs needed for the facility and how much the enhancements would cost. And so this is basically the Bengals primarily saying, we want to have a better looking stadium and, deciding how much of that the county is willing to pay for. So I don't think this really has any impact on that, just as it's part of the public discussion that's going to start, I think, increasing soon as the current lease expiration date comes up.
Okay. Well, I have been talking with WVXU local government reporter Becca Costello. Thanks so much for your time today, Becca.
Thank you, Lucy.
Up next, FC Cincinnati's Hell is Real showdown is this weekend. We'll discuss what's at stake. This is Cincinnati Edition. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Lucy May. FC Cincinnati faces off against Columbus Crew this weekend in the latest Hell is Real showdown, and there's more at stake than ever before. Joining me now to break it down is Queen City Press founder Laurel Failer. Thanks for being here, Laurel.
Thanks for having me.
And WVXU senior editor and reporter Tana Weingartner. Welcome back, Tana.
I'm excited to be here.
I'm excited to have you both here. Laurel, how big a deal is Saturday's match? How high are the stakes?
Yeah, I mean, this is the biggest game. I mean, it's the biggest game in Ohio history of soccer. Just as far as, you know, MLS has never had, they've never even had an in-state conference final anywhere. So to have one in Ohio, obviously the rivalry is one of the biggest in MLS. So the first time that these two have faced off in an elimination game. So yeah, it's a big one for sure.
A big one. Tana, explain the history of this Hell is Real rivalry. For listeners who may not be familiar.
For the non-soccer aficionados.
Yeah.
Right. So once FC Cincinnati, you know, got a thing, it started with they were in the lower tier, the USL. So some fans just kind of got to chatting. They're like, what are we going to call it when the two teams play each other? And a Cincinnati fan and a Columbus fan that kind of knew each other both at the same time basically tweeted out, oh, Hell is Real, based on that sign that you've probably seen if you've ever driven on I-71 right. Between Columbus and Cincinnati. It's a little closer to Columbus.
A big old billboard.
Big old billboard that says Hell is Real. And then there's another one that has like the Ten Commandments on it or something.
Yep.
And so it just kind of really took off from there. The fans really claimed onto it. And then the teams were like, well, we're going to get in on that too. And then MLS was like, let's monetize it.
Yeah. I mean, the fact that it's so organic is what makes it great. Because you feel like some of these rivalries, they just kind of have to manufacture some kind
right.
of, you know, manufacture their rivalry or even just the name to it. And this
exactly.
one's totally organic, made by the fans. It's great.
Yeah, I agree.
Laurel, what will the winner of this match get out of the victory beyond bragging rights, which are very important, but...
Well, they get to host MLS Cup. So whoever wins, it's either going to be in Columbus or Cincinnati. And I mean, that's huge. That's just a spectacle in itself. So that'd be a huge thing for Cincinnati. You know, Columbus has hosted before. So they've been there. And yeah, I mean, one more win and they're there.
Wow. And this is the big game, right? This is the Super Bowl for soccer, you know, the World Series. It's one match and it's the biggest one of the whole thing. You win and... like, you know, you get to do the dance and wear the hats and the confetti and you get the trophy. It's the big deal.
You mean the cup game is, not
yes.
not this one.
Right. I mean, there'll be dancing and confetti and hats after this one, too, but not a trophy.
No. Yeah, I mean, obviously Cincinnati won the regular season, but in America, we have that tendency to put the emphasis on the playoffs. So it's the big, they're one step away from that Super Bowl for MLS, basically.
The big one. So, Laurel, how has FC Cincinnati gotten to this point in the season? What's been the key to the team's success up to this point?
Well, really, I mean, you kind of look at FC Cincinnati as a two-year building under Chris Albright, their general manager, and Pat Noonan, the coach. You know, they really turned around from after 3 years of finishing last. They brought in Chris Albright as their GM and Pat Noonan as coach, and those two really... just brought in some MLS experience and turned things around last year. So they made the playoffs for the first time last year, won one playoff game, and then lost to Philadelphia in the Eastern Conference semifinals. So this year they've kind of really just built on that. I think the defense has been the big key this year. They really shored things up, bringing in a guy, Yerson Mosquera, on loan from an EPL team in England for newer to the English Premier League, Wolverhampton. He's been a solid addition to the back line. And it's been just they've won a lot of close games. They've won in a lot of different ways. And I think that's really been the key for them, just showing their depth in different ways.
Yeah. Tana, you've reported on some accolades that
sure.
FC Cincinnati has gotten this year. How has all that played into it?
Right. So like talking what Laurel's talking about there with Pat Noonan, he's the MLS Coach of the Year. This is voted on by fans, by media, and by the team staffs themselves. And with Chris Allwright and Pat Noonan, these are two guys that understand Major League Soccer. So like a lot of times people think we need to bring in, you know, the person from Europe or the person from wherever. But these guys understand what this league is and how this league works and who the people are that can be successful here. And then the team also brought in the MLS MVP, who ended up being the MLS MVP, Luciano Acosta, who just, you know, he's a real difference maker in the midfield. It's kind of like watching a dance when he's on the ball and he directs. And the thing I think that helps make him successful is that all his teammates really seem to enjoy him and like him, and that, you know, you don't have the jerk that just wants to be, you know, the number 10, which is, you know, the big successful jersey, your playmaker. But he, you know, so that cohesiveness really helps drive that.
Is he like the Joe Burrow of SC Cincinnati?
Kind of. I don't know. I mean, he is kind of a fashionista also.
Yeah, I would definitely. I mean, I did a story on him last year because someone showed him a book on Joe Burrow. Like, you need to study this guy. This is who you need to pattern because he's a captain as well. And so he wanted to kind of learn how to be a better leader. And I mean, he's really developed as a leader, I think, is the big key for him. That's why he ended up MVP this year.
Huh.
And like overwhelmingly so, like 60% of the overall vote. So
wasn't even close.
No.
Yeah.
Yeah. The next person had like 15%.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
Yeah, we won that one. So, Laurel, what's the track record in this rivalry and the Hell is Real rivalry? How has FC Cincinnati done over the years?
Well, Columbus does have the edge, but FC Cincinnati is 2-1-3 at home. So 3 draws is the 3. So they only have 1 loss at home against Columbus. At home this year, they won 3-2. They went up ahead 2-0 and looked like they were in control, gave up 2 goals, and then ended up with the game winner. And then Roman Celentano had the save of the year, actually, in that game to preserve that win. On the road this year, FC Cincinnati lost 3-0. But they were without Yersa Mosquera and Matt Miazga, who they're going to be missing for this game as well, and for the remainder of the playoffs, unfortunately. Yeah. But they don't play as well on the road against Columbus. It just hasn't ever gone well for them there. So
like one of those psychological things maybe or something. It's just like they have their number, it seems.
Yeah, yeah. Laurel, FC Cincinnati's victory over Philadelphia was a big deal. Does that provide a blueprint or a roadmap at all for Saturday's match?
I mean, it gives you confidence in the defense that they were without Matt Miazga in that game, the MLS Defender of the Year. If you've missed that, he's suspended for misconduct related to an incident after the November 4th game at New York Red Bulls. So he is out, but they had two other really strong defenders out. They had Obi Wobodo as their defensive midfielder. He was out. And then Santiago Arias, their right wing back, he was out. So, or he was on the bench but didn't play. So those two guys are available this week. And just seeing that they were able to overcome those absences and play really well defensively, they won 1-0, got the shutout. I think that gives you confidence that they can do it again, even though I would say that Columbus is a little different of an attack and probably provides a few more challenges.
Yeah. I want to talk a little bit more about this, the fact that they'll be missing this star defender. Tell us a little bit more about this incident for people who aren't clued in to what went down.
Lucy is like, you know, stirring up.
That's right. I'm stirring the pot. I'm the Andy Cohen of this conversation.
I mean, we can't have a conversation about FC Cincinnati this week and not talk about that. So, I mean, yeah. So he had gotten 2 yellow cards right at the end of the match. You can say that they were soft yellow cards. So he did have probably an argument, you know, but he, you know, I guess it was about 80 minutes after the game, he ended up going in the locker room. And that hasn't been disputed.
And we should say the referee's locker room.
Locker room. Yeah. Sorry. I've written so much about this. So he ended up going in their locker room to have a conversation. And the dispute is whether, you know, how violent or abusive he was, you know, what kind of language he was using. It's, you know, people are saying different things on that end. But he definitely went in, and kind of the standard for that is you get a 3-game suspension. MLS doesn't have a specific policy to that, but U.S. Soccer does. So it kind of seems like that was the guideline. He went in the locker room, and that, you know, whatever happened outside of that and inside the locker room is still a little fuzzy with different accounts. But MLS ended up giving him probably what was the minimum punishment, 3 games, effective immediately. So he'll be out at least the first game of next season too, and then a fine as well.
So you're just not supposed to go in that locker room, even if you're super polite, you're not supposed to go in the referee's locker room after the game.
Yeah, I mean, it says outside on their authorized access only. So those signs are posted all over. It's just, I mean, it's kind of the ref's safe space. And yeah, so that they had a huge problem with feeling like their space was violated. And so it kind of started with them putting out a statement saying MLS needs to do something about this and kind of rolled from there.
Well, and you said it was a long time. It was 80 minutes after the game.
Yeah. So, I mean, that was the thing that, you know, there was this when it first came out, it kind of made it seem like, oh, yeah, he stormed in right after the game. And so in that sense, you're imagining that he was probably very, very emotional. You know, that it was 80 minutes after the game, you kind of get more of a sense that maybe he was a little calmed down and just want to have a conversation. But, you know, we really don't know. Like I said, there's been a lot of different accounts of what happened. So,
Tan, as a fan, what do you think about that?
Well, as the fan who can look at it from like a further back perspective, because a lot of fans are just mad, and they're mad, as Laurel referenced, the soft yellows, and should those have even been calls, and so whatever, you know, and the refs were in the wrong and all the rest of it, and the refs came out with their statement before you know, anything was ever sort of verified or said or and the rest of that. But the long and short of it is, you are a professional athlete and you are in charge of yourself and you're responsible for your own actions. You have to, you know, think with your head, not with your heart in these situations. That's my fan perspective, which I know is probably not very popular with a lot of fans. But I will say another friend of ours, longtime soccer blogger, Wrong Side of the Pond, DJ Switzer, also agrees.
I mean, in that situation, you need to let your team handle it.
Yeah.
You know, they can take it to the official. You know, nothing might change, but I mean, he wasn't going to change anything. And it was just, he ended up jeopardizing things for his team.
Yeah. Laurel, there's so much excitement about this team right now. Do you think it's because they're actually doing well? I mean, when you look at how the Reds season ended, you look at how the Bengals season is going. I mean, do you think that's part of it?
I mean, FC Cincinnati has the potential to bring the first championship here since, what, 1990?
Was that when? 96? Yeah, it's been a long time.
Yeah. The Reds won in 1990. 90s, yeah. So, I think there's a lot of excitement as they're getting deeper and get closer. I think more people are paying attention. I mean, FC Cincinnati has a huge, I mean, they sell out almost every game. I think this is their 18th sellout for MLS games.
And it's such a reward for a fan base that has been so loyal since the beginning. Like people showing up, you know, the march, it's just insanity. And it's like, it's what they deserve, right? Yeah. The fans deserve it.
These are not fair weather fans, that's for sure. Yeah. Well, I've been talking with Queen City Press founder Laurel Failer and WVXU senior editor and reporter Tana Weingartner. Thank you both so much for your time today.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Our producer is Selena Reeder. Associate producer is Asiya Johnson. Technical director is Marshall Verbsky. If you miss our program live, you can subscribe to Cincinnati Edition wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Lucy May. Thank you so much for listening.